All right, they got it in a way that we don't. So we need to learn. There needs to be a humility about us as we look back to the life of, you know, Abraham and Sarah. And tonight we'll see Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and, you know, Enoch and Noah. But, you know, this thing about faith, it's not desperately trying to believe something that we suspect isn't true. You know, it's not a leap in the dark. It's not an irrational thing. It's not blind. It's not some mystical, psychological experience where we work ourselves up to really believe something's going to happen. Remember, faith is simply our spirit-given ability to believe that the world, that God, that reality is the way Jesus says it is. And to make our decisions to live accordingly. We've begun to unpack some of the things that characterize a life that's lived like that. A life that is born out of just listening to Jesus and believing that the world is the way he says it is. That we saw the way it shapes our worship. We've seen the way it brings us into conflict with a world around us that doesn't share that way of making sense of the world, of interpreting the world, doesn't think the world is the way Jesus says it is. And we've seen the way it shapes our life so that we're actually, in some ways, quite radically out of step with so many other people who we share life with. But, you know, we're learning to walk with God like Enoch. It shapes how we understand where the world came from, the whole question of origins and therefore of meaning and of significance. It shapes our whole understanding about where the world's going to and how it's going to end up. And it teaches us to fear the Lord who we've just confessed will come again in glory to judge the living and the dead. It teaches us to live in the light of that judgment, not to fear the judgment, but to fear the God who comes in judgment. We saw from Abraham and Sarah, it cultivates this pilgrimage mentality. You know, this world is not our home, or at least this age is not our home. We're looking forward to a new creation, a new age, a resurrection age. And so we don't invest in this life in the way that maybe we once did. Abraham living in a tent. And it's interesting, in the New Testament, Paul picks that language of living in a tent up, and he actually applies it to kind of our body. He talks about the tent of this body and how, you know, this is just a temporary dwelling as we pilgrimage through this age. But we're looking forward to our resurrection bodies where we're going to be living for eternity. And we have that longing for the age to come, for the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. We're homesick for Zion. That's what faith cultivates in us, a whole matrix of attitudes and characteristics that shape our life and relativize our relationship with this world. And we saw last week just how precious and valuable a thing our faith is and how God will put us into incredibly challenging, very painful, sometimes very sacrificial circumstances in order to grow our faith and develop our faith and mature our faith and to supply what's lacking in our faith. That's kind of where we've been over the last few weeks. Over the next couple of weeks, we're going to look at the battle for faith. As we look at Moses and Joshua, some of the enemies of our faith, the things that would undermine our faith, rob us of our faith, that would damage our faith and stunt its growth. We're going to see some of that being tackled in Hebrews. But tonight I want to very specifically think about dying by faith. We've been thinking about living by faith. And that's one thing. It's another thing to die by faith. And I need to tell you, I'm going to skip over Isaac. All right? And I'm really gutted. I should have given Isaac a week all to himself. I can't even tell you, like, I can't even give you headlines on it. I just don't even have time to do that. But I think, actually, I want to focus in on Jacob and Joseph. And I want to, because both for both of these guys, their faith is linked very specifically to their approaching death. And I think Hebrews 11 is asking the question, what does it mean to die by faith? So Jacob, his faith when he was dying. Joseph, when his end was near. How, when you live by faith, when how do you approach death? What does a faithful death look like? All right. Sometimes people wonder about the relevance of what preached in church. I imagine that tonight the question of relevance might not come up, because unless Jesus comes back before our time is up, death is something that we will all have to negotiate on a very personal and individual basis. And I would imagine that most of the people in the room, if not all of us, have, you know, we've been touched by death. Death has come very close and has taken someone whom we have loved and shared life with. So this is an incredibly relevant question. We looked at the whole question of death and dying a couple of years ago in the Lent course. And I, when I was researching for that course, I came across this idea of the death clock. Now, it's one of the weird things you can do online when you've got, like, you know, nothing better to do with your life. There's this website where you can go and you can enter in all this information about yourself, and it will predict when you are going to die. It'll give you a date. Now, you know, it's probably not right. But, it, you know, I don't think anybody's ever done that test and has come back going, oh, no date for you. You know what I mean? The date might be wrong. But we all know, when we stop and think about it, that there is a date when our heart will stop beating. We will die in that physical sense of the world. So I want to suggest this is very relevant for us as Christians. Every bit as relevant as the question of how we live by faith will be the question of how we grow old, how we approach death, and how we die. How do we die as Christians? We were chatting about this earlier over coffee before the service, and just saying, you know, in the olden days, Christians used to invite everybody over when they knew they were going to die. And they were like, come, nothing will convince you of the truth of the gospel more than watching someone die who has believed it. That the death of a Christian is a very different thing to behold than the death of someone who isn't. Because we have this conviction that actually death is not the end. We saw last week that, you know, Abraham believed in the resurrection. There's a hope of a life that goes beyond death. And so how does that shape us as we approach death in a faith-filled way? And it should make as much of a difference to how we approach death as it does to how we have lived life. And we all know, like, you know, old people who've grown bitter and resentful, and, you know, they just complain about everything. And they're self-indulgent, and they're manipulative, and they're living in the past. And you know, they're not nice. They're not nice. They're grumpy. And you can feel their sense of, you know, they've had their time, and they're just waiting for the clock to tick down. And this is not how Christians are supposed to approach death. It's not how we're supposed to grow old. It's not how we're supposed to die. We have before us the hope of resurrection and new creation. I mean, if you've picked up nothing from the book of Hebrews, the idea of resurrection and new creation as being the goal, if you like, of our faith, surely we've picked this up. And we, in a way, we spend our whole life learning how to live by faith so that when we face this last great enemy, this last battle, we've got a lifetime of having practiced faith so that as we stand looking into the valley of the shadow of death, we can walk into it with faith in our risen Lord, faith that his resurrection means we will be resurrected, faith that there is a new creation that we will be a part of, faith that as we step into death, we step into the presence of Jesus, who is life. And so we start with Jacob. Jacob, who's probably most famous for his wrestling with the angel of the Lord. Jacob has this wild journey of faith. We might do Genesis next year. I don't know. I'm not sure I'm good enough to preach Genesis, to be honest. I don't think I've got enough of a handle on what's going on, but it's getting close. I'm beginning to understand some of what's going on in Genesis, and maybe enough to have a first crack at preaching it with you. But Jacob, his story in Genesis, he's got this wild journey. He starts off being this guy who bargains with God. You know, God, if you do this for me, if you provide this for me, if you lead me, and guy, if you do all these things for me, then I will worship you. And you read through Jacob's life and his faith, it kind of ebbs and flows. There are times when he seems to be shaped by it, and there are times when it just seems to fall apart, and he's just like a, you know, like anybody else who doesn't have a relationship with Jesus. And so, you know what I mean? And he has to kind of learn the hard way not to rely on himself and on his own ingenuity. He has to learn the hard way to trust God, to rely on God, to follow God's ways. He has to be broken, like quite literally, he's broken by this encounter with the angel of the Lord that we read about in Genesis 32. And he walks away from that encounter, having been blessed by the Lord Jesus, but being forever wounded by it. You know, he walks away from that limping, and he spends the rest of his life leaning on his staff. The sign of his kind of leaning on the Lord, his dependence on the Lord. And it's really interesting that he becomes so focused in. It's a great story of watching someone grow in faith until their faith in Christ is all they have. He becomes so focused on the promises of Jesus that actually he gets to the point where they have this whole thing going on with the promised land that we've been looking at over the last few weeks. And the way that kind of represents life in the new creation. Well, Jacob gets to the point where he won't leave that land. Even though he hasn't come into possession of it yet, even though he has not yet inherited it, he will not leave that land until the Lord comes and says, "It's all right, mate. I promise you, I will bring you back." Genesis 46, he's like, he's on the border. He will not leave the land, though, until the Lord comes and says, "I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will bring you back again." And it's while he is in Egypt that this thing that Hebrews 11 picks up, that he blesses his adopted sons. All right, he takes the sons of Joseph, Ephraim and Manasseh, these guys who've been born to Joseph in Egypt. You know, in a sense, they've never been a part of what God is doing in the promised land. And Jacob kind of catches them up. He kind of adopts them as his own sons, and he adopts them and brings them into the promises of God and into the flow of what God is doing in the ancient church. And he does it, we're told in Hebrews 11, worshiping, leaning on the top of his staff. That thing that has become so emblematic of his faith. And as his body grows weaker, Jacob's spirit and his faith grows stronger. And he has this great insight into the plans and the purposes of God. And so when he's blessing Ephraim and Manasseh, it's interesting, he blesses them. He blesses them into the inheritance of a land that he doesn't yet possess to give. He's so confident of the future God has promised the church that he blesses them with that future. And then he says to Joseph, the Lord changes Jacob's name to Israel. And he says to Joseph, I'm about to die, but God will be with you. And he will take you back to the land of your fathers. And to you I will give you one more ridge of land, Shechem, the bit that Abraham had bought all those years ago to bury Sarah in. I will give you that rather than give it to your brothers. You know, it's been 200 years since God first promised Abraham that this land would be theirs. And for three long generations, they have lived and died and not come into possessing that land. In fact, at this point, as Jacob dies, none of the church are in the promised land. They're all in Egypt. All of them. It never looks less likely that God's promise is actually going to be fulfilled. And yet, Jacob commissions his sons, makes them promise that they will not bury him in Egypt. He gave them these instructions. I'm about to be gathered to my people. What a great way to talk about death. I'm about to go to be with the church triumphant. I'm about to go to be with the saints who have died in the faith and fear of God. I'm about to go to be with my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave, in the field of Ephron the Hittite, the cave in the field of Machpelah, near Mamre in Canaan, which Abraham bought. All right, it's just so confident. Take me back to Canaan. I don't want to be a part of Egypt. I reject this. I mean, his son is like the second most important person in the world. And he's like, I don't want to be a part of any of that. I just want to go back to the promise of God. All right. Just his faith is totally tied up with the new creation. All right. So that's Jacob. Now hold that thought as we go on to Joseph. You know, Joseph and his amazing technicolor dream coat and all of that sort of stuff. He's a very different guy. All right. Jacob's faith ebbs and flows. It's wild. It's torrid. It's there. It's not there. When it's there, it's immense. And when it collapses, it's catastrophe to behold. Joseph is a much more steady guy. All right. He's just got this incredible, steady, persevering confidence in God's purposes. From the moment we first meet Joseph, you know, he's a young guy, and yet already he has this great confidence in God's promises. He knows God's purposes. He knows God's plans. He knows what the future holds. And it's like whatever happens to him, you know, you think about the stuff that goes on. He's betrayed. He's thrown into a pit. He's sold into slavery. Yeah, he suffers injustice at the hands of Potiphar and his wife. All of that, he never died. We're never in the Bible told. It's not like Jacob, whose faith is there or not there. It grows, it shrinks. It's an incredible, like Joseph, just rock solid, right? Just steady confidence, always patiently trusting in God. And he knows what the Lord said to Abraham. He knows that for 400 years, the church will be strangers in Egypt, in a country not their own. And that in the fourth generation, your descendants will come back to this promised land. See, Joseph knows that, and he's got no intention of missing out on the moment when the church finally comes into the inheritance of God's promises. And so Joseph, he's like, I'm about to die, but God will come to your aid. He will take you up out of this land to the land that he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made the Israelites swear an oath and said, God will come to your aid. He will deliver you like he promised you. And when he does, carry my bones up from this place. It's like, you know, I'll just be a skeleton by then, but I still want to be a part of the Exodus and this moment when the church comes into inheritance and into the promised land. And he's totally vindicated. You know, Exodus 13, Moses did exactly what Joseph asked. He took the bones of Joseph with him because Joseph had made the Israelites swear an oath. He said, God will come to your aid. Surely come to your aid, and you must carry up my bones with you from this place. And in Joshua 24, we read they're buried in the same field that Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob were buried. And two very, very different men, very different lives, very different spiritual journeys and experiences. Both of them, you see, their life of faith growing and developing in such different ways. It's hard to imagine two people who are more different from each other. And yet, when it comes to the point of their death, they behave in exactly the same way. All right, so that, you know, our however we live the life of faith, it seems to me that when we come to die the death of faith, there's much greater consistency of experience. You know, that it's much more kind of by the book, as it were. You know, they both face death with incredible composure and courage and confidence in God's purposes for them as they go forward through death, but also incredible confidence for God's purposes for those whom they are leaving behind, carrying on in the life of the church militant. They face death without fear. That's so important. Remember right back in Hebrews chapter 2. The children have flesh and blood. Jesus too shared their humanity so that by his death he might break the power of him who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and free those who all their lives were held in slavery by their fear of death. Right? And then you watch Christians die. And the one thing that characterizes all of us as we face death with faith is we are no longer held in slavery by our fear of death. I don't know if you can remember when we preached on this. It was about a year ago. But we were just showing how the whole of our culture is built on fear of death. And so much of our life is shaped by and defined by fear of dying. Our whole culture is riddled with this stuff. And yet, how different those who live by faith and who approach death by faith. Jacob and Joseph, in spite of all the differences in their life of faith, as they come to die, they are composed, dignified. There's this simple confidence in the purposes of God. There's assurance in their own future, assurance in the church's future, assurance for the future of those that they are leaving behind, and confidence in God's dealing with them by grace, and they step into death without fear. In fact, there's almost the fact that I'm dying is neither here nor there. Both of them, as they approach death, their whole agenda is about encouraging and praying for the people who they're going to be leaving behind. Interesting. It's like we're about to die. And so what we want to do is bless those who we're going to encourage those we're leaving behind. Stir up the faith of those we are leaving behind. Because our fight is over. Their fight is still going on. Our race is done. But they've got to keep on running. So their whole focus of attention seems to not really be on the fact that they're about to die. That's almost neither here nor there. The focus of their attention is, I want to bless those who still have to live in the tent of this body. I want to bless and encourage those and stir up the faith of those who are still in pilgrimage with the Lord in this age. I'm not really concerned about the fact that I'm dying. Death holds no threat for me. I'm concerned for those I'm leaving behind. It's an extraordinary thing. You think, how can you face something so monumental and yet be so completely focused on other people? How do you get to the place where as you are preparing to step into the valley of the shadow of death, you're like, yeah, whatever. The important thing is you guys. Let me pray for you. Let me bless you. Let me teach you. Let me encourage you, because what's happening to you is far more important and significant than what's happening to me as I die. Well, let's just think about that for a few minutes, because I think this is the key, really. This is what helps us understand people like Jacob and Joseph. And it starts with our remembering that death is not just a natural thing. Death is not just the next step in the journey of life. It's not just the next turn of the circle of life. Death is not a natural, good, friendly thing. Death is an enemy. Death is an intruder in God's good creation. When God declared the world to be good, when God looked at the world and said, this is good, death was not a part of it. Right? Death comes as a result of human sinfulness. Death is part of judgment. It's part of the curse. It's part of condemnation. It's what came into the world when we ruptured and dislocated our relationship with God, who is the fountain of life. It's as we wrenched ourselves away from Him in disobedience that we cut ourselves off from life. And that is when death becomes part of our experience. Sin entered the world through one man, through Adam. And death through sin. And in this way, death came to all people because all sinned. Right? It's as simple as that. Or even more succinctly, Romans chapter 6, the wages of sin is death. Yeah, now, think back to Hebrews 2. All right? Christ comes and in His death, yeah, He disempowers death. You see, He takes our sin, doesn't He? As Jesus dies on the cross, He takes our sin to Himself and He deals with it. He bears the judgment for it. So that the if you like, the connection between sin and death is broken. We still have to die. We live in a cursed, condemned world. Death is still part of our experience. We have to die. That's how. It doesn't matter. All right, we have to die. Let's just accept that for tonight. Just looking at the clock. All right. But our sin, the sin that makes death such a painful and terrifying experience, the thing that makes death something to be afraid of, is our sin. And the fact that death is part of the judgment against our sin. So when sin is dealt with, death is no longer something that needs to terrify us. All right. Now, for Jacob and Joseph and for all the saints in the Old Testament, for all those who lived before the cross, all right, they were still trusting. They were still putting their faith in Jesus and what Jesus was going to do in the cross. Exactly the same way as we do. We put our faith in what Jesus has done in the cross. We're looking back to the cross. They're looking forward to the cross, and they are putting their trust in what Jesus is going to do. And God deals with them on the basis of what Christ will do for them on the cross. It's like when the sun shines at midday. All right, so imagine the sun in the center of the sky. Yeah? But it's not like, okay, this bit's all light and this bit's all darkness. The sun casts its light both sort of east and west, Right? Now think of the cross standing at the fullness of time. The cross, the benefits of the cross, the effect of the cross run both backwards and forwards through history. All right? Before the cross, the saints of God who were looking forward, they knew what Jesus was going to do when he came. They knew what he was going to do when he died. They're putting their trust in that. Their faith is focused on that. And their sin was dealt with every bit as fully and as finally as ours at the cross. And God deals with them on the basis, if you like, on credit, on the basis of what Christ is going to do for them. Yeah. So even though Christ hasn't died yet, the effects of the cross, is so inevitable that the benefits of the cross in dealing with sin is made available to the patriarchs even before it's happened. And so because these guys are looking forward to that and God is dealing with them on the basis of what Jesus will do, taking their sin, bearing their sin, dying in terms of judgment, dying in their place. All right? Stealing the sting of death for them. Which means they then enter death without fear. Death does not have that terror for them. Remains a reality. We live in a fallen world. We live in a cursed world. We still have to die. But like everything else, our experience of death has been redeemed. And when somebody steps into death whose sin has been dealt with, whose sin has been taken from them, when somebody steps into death in that state, death performs a very different function. Death becomes the entrance into life with Christ. It becomes the thing that reconciles us to the Jesus that we have loved and followed for our whole lives. It becomes the thing that takes us to the fulfillment of everything we have lived for and everything that we have longed for. It carries us into the presence of our God. And that was as true for the patriarchs as it is for us. All right, let me show you this from Jesus' teaching. Do you remember in Luke chapter 16, Jesus tells a story. This is before Jesus dies on the cross. In Luke 16, he tells a story about a rich man and a beggar named Lazarus. Now, some people think this is a parable. I'll be really honest with you about that. Some people think it's a parable. I don't think it's a parable, because in parables, people don't have names. All right? And in this story, the people have names. And in the story, both Lazarus and David, the rich guy, die, and they go to their destiny, their eternal destinies. And where does the beggar go? Who is the beggar with in that story? Abraham. All right? Before the death of Jesus, Abraham is seen in the glory of God the Father. Or think about Mark chapter 12, where Jesus is having a right old crack with the Sadducees. And the Sadducees don't believe in resurrection. And Jesus is like, you're just flat wrong. You're just wrong. You don't know the Bible. You don't know the power of God. You don't know what you're talking about. You're just wrong. And he says, look, you know, I'll tell you that God is the God of the living, because he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are with God living before Jesus dies on the cross. They are with his Father. Right? Before the cross has happened, these Old Testament saints are treated on the basis of what Jesus will do for them, in the same way as we are treated on the basis of what Jesus has done for us. So for all their differences in their experience of the life of faith, when it comes to dying, Joseph and Jacob, faith in the cross, faith in what Christ is going to do, and so they face death without fear. And their focus and their concern is on those who they are leaving behind. They want to do everything they can in their dying moments to make sure that those who are leaving behind continue to persevere in the race of faith, continue to persevere in the fight of faith. They pray for them, bless them, teach them, stir up their faith so that they will keep going. And this has always been how Christians face death. This is one of my favorite, I think, most brilliant theologians who's ever lived. He's a guy called John Flavel. He lived back in the 1600s, and he wrote a book. He wrote a lot of books. But in one of them, he says this. He says, death is harmless to the people of God. So why are we afraid to die if there's no sting? If we were to die in our sins, if death were a tyrant, the precursor of hell, then you might shrink back from it with horror and dismay. But if your sins are blotted out, if Christ has vanquished death in your behalf so that you have nothing to encounter but bodily pain, and possibly not even that, if death be to you the forerunner of heaven, then why should you be afraid? Why not bid it welcome? It cannot hurt you. Right? In fact, Christians sometimes get a little bit cavalier about it. This is another guy, old guy, similar sort of period in history. A guy called Richard Baxter. And he wrote a book called The Saints' Everlasting Rest. He was a hypochondriac. The guy always thought he was dying. Like every, you'd get a toothache and he'd be like, oh, this is it, I'm going to die. So he wrote a lot about death because he sort of kept thinking he was going to die and then he didn't. And then next time he'd write another bit. Anyway, one of the things he says is, he said, I have to guard against the temptation that would carry me to the extreme of taking nothing but heaven to be worth minding. That I might even sinfully cast off the world on the pretense of mortification and my anticipation of a heavenly life. I have to remind myself that God has work for me to do here and use to be made of me here for the service of his church on earth. But a man that is traveling to the most desirable home has a desire to be there all the way during his journey. But his present business is his journey. His horse, his inns, his company, his road, his fatigues may employ more of his thoughts, talk, and action than his home. You see, he saw this life as just a journey to his actual home. Pilgrim mentality. Waiting to die so he could go and be with Jesus. All right? And he's like, do you know what? I so want to be there. I so want to die that it's almost like that's all I could ever think about that had any value. I have to remind myself that, no, God has got use for me here, and I need to stay here for a bit. It's Paul in Philippians chapter 1, isn't it? Remember there, he's saying, look, you know, I'd rather die. To be honest, I would rather die and go and be with Jesus, but I know that it will be of more benefit to you if I stay. And so I know I'm going to have to wait before I get to go and be with Jesus, so that I can build up the church. Which is exactly what we saw in Jacob and Joseph. As they stand on the brink of the valley of the shadow of death, what are they doing? They're blessing those they're leaving behind. Praying for those they're leaving behind. Teaching those they are leaving behind. Holding the promises of Christ out to those they are leaving behind. Hold on to these. Keep going. Let's go back to, here's another quote from Flavel. It might prevent your heart from shrinking back if you consider that death is necessary to fit you for the full enjoyment of God. Death must do you the kind office to remove this veil of flesh. Who would not be willing to die for the perfect enjoyment of God? Who would not be willing to die for the perfect enjoyment of God? Most men need patience to die. But a saint who truly understands what death would introduce him to would need patience to live. See where it just changes, this changes. To die with faith changes the whole perspective of how we approach this. In fact, for Christians, you might remember this when we looked at it in the Lent course a couple of years ago. For Christians, there's this idea that to lie down to die is no more troublesome than to lie down at the end of a hard day's work in order to rest and sleep. So Paul, writing in 1 Thessalonians, says this, oh, brothers and sisters, we don't want you to be uninformed about those who sleep in death, so that you don't grieve like the rest of mankind who have no hope. See, this doesn't just affect how we die. It affects how we grieve for others who have died as well. This idea that death is just like going to bed. It's just like falling asleep. We get this from Jesus. After Jesus, he's talking to his disciples, he went on to tell them, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. He had died. They buried him in a tomb. And Jesus is like, yeah, he's fallen asleep. But don't worry, I'm going there to wake him up. We get the same idea right back in the book of Genesis. When Jacob dies, we watch Jacob dying. And when he's finished giving instructions to his sons, so he preaches this last epic sermon to his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, was gathered to his people. It's just like going to sleep. Now, I want to stop here, actually. I'm going to stop. But to have the faith that allows you to die like this is something you have to fight for. Something you have to work for. It's something you have to prepare for through your whole life. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to look at what that battle looks like. What are some of the enemies of faith? And how do we fight those enemies in order to strengthen our faith so that we can live and die as men and women characterized by faith. But I want to finish with this one last quote from John Owen, possibly the greatest Bible student that the English-speaking world has ever seen. Phenomenal guy. I think he's like, anyway, don't matter. He preached a sermon at a funeral of someone who was in the congregation that he was a pastor of. And just listen to this, because I think, you know, as a church, we've seen our share of death. And we've seen Christians die. And if you think about some of those folk, you'll recognize some of the things that I've been saying about tonight. We've seen this. We know this isn't hypothetical. We have seen this in the experience of people who we know, who we have loved, and who we have watched die. We have seen them die with faith. And this is from a funeral sermon that was preached about 450 years ago. God has taken from this congregation a justified man, a Christian. I was with him the day before he died, and I found him in such exercise of faith as ever I would desire to live and die in. That view which God had given him of his glory, his wisdom, his righteousness, his grace, his love, his mercy, all manifested in Jesus Christ from the saving of his soul. I know no more glorious act of faith. You hear that? To die with faith is the most glorious act of faith that any Christian can enter into. So Father, we're not playing games here tonight, Lord. This isn't just ritual. But we're talking about the most cosmic, the most profound realities of which we are aware. Literally life and death stuff. We want to die well. We want to die in a way that honors Christ, that speaks of our confidence that in His death, Christ has destroyed death. We want to stand on the edge of the valley of the shadow of death. We want to look into it and we want to say with the Apostle Paul, where, O death, is your victory? Where, O grave, is your sting? We want to know that death has been swallowed up in victory. Father, please, will you prepare us for that day? That day when it will be our time. And we will face this last great enemy. Lord, on that day, let us do it in a way that is shaped by our faith. And Father, whatever needs to happen between now and then to prepare us for that, Lord, please do it. Because in that moment, we do not want our faith to fail. We want to live by faith, and we want to die by faith. Because that is how we honor Jesus. And it is in His name we pray.